Good morning. 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the length of time it took for George Floyd to die when a policeman knelt on his neck as three other officers looked on. On Monday's Drive Time, Katie Hannon spoke to Bonnie Greer, commentator and author of the podcast series In Search of Black History.
You've lived through the civil rights years, the LA riots that followed the acquittal of the four police officers for beating Rodney King, the election of President Obama, the Black Lives Matter campaign. What do the events of the last 6 days tell us about where we are now and the state of US race relations in 2020?
It shows how systemic racism is in the United States. And these events that you're talking about happened within the course of my adult lifetime, which, you know, is a couple of decades, 5 decades. So it's not a long time. And if we look at the founding of the United States and how it has succeeded and gone through the world, its foundation is racism. It's a racist settler country. And Americans, we tend to be very romantic. And the individual American, I would say, is a person who strives to make herself a better person in the country. But the country doesn't deal with its origin. And that's the part that makes it fall into something like this, because it won't do it. It doesn't do it. The history is not taught properly in school. It's lied about. We don't talk about the history of our relationships of various ethnic groups in the United States, the tensions that have been fomented between them, amongst them. Never discussed in the United States, except when something like this happens, because the United States maintains a kind of dream state that it lives in, and then it explodes.
Bonnie Greer with Katie Hannon on Drive Time. The following day, Mary Wilson spoke to Dr. Andre Perry of the Brookings Institute, who studies the economic divide between Black and White America.
So much of the attention has been focusing on the rioters, but we don't see the policy violence that has been leveled upon Black communities for decades, if not generations. And by the way, police are protecting and serving. But when you look at the data that shows that Black people in Minnesota are pulled over or stopped 2.5 times more than white residents, then it's not surprising to learn that Black residents or Black folk in that area earn half as much as white residents. And so we see that police are protecting and serving, but not necessarily protecting and serving Black people. They're protecting the people who are benefiting from unjust policy. And so there's a lot of frustration on the part of Black communities. When will the policy violence stop? When police stop killing Black people for nonviolent offenses?
Dr. Andre Perry on Drive Time. But what of the view from the US itself and its citizens? Well, on Tuesday, Joe Duffy spoke to Sharon in Texas. She's part of the Irish American Society there, and she condemned the actions of the police officers involved.
It's not police. It's individuals. Every walk of life has good people and they have bad people. He just happened to be a bad apple.
The bad apple defence. However, when it came to the protests, Sharon knew what was really going on.
Antifa.
The anti-fascist group.
It's just, we know about them, but yeah, but they don't talk about them.
Well, how many are in Antifa? Who are they?
I'm not sure who the leader is. It's like that George Soros is one of the main little people who was a multi-billionaire.
Yeah, what you're saying, he does primarily a philanthropist. You're saying
he is the root of all the problems. Even the police shootings. You know, like I said, with the police shootings, you know, in 2016. Because, like I said, my niece was a police officer.
Okay,
he's the cause of it.
Well, prepare thyself for a spluttering and rather incredulous Joe Duffy.
What?
Because of George Soros. All these far left groups have gotten started, and
Sharon, this has gone all Trump on me. You're saying George Soros is the cause of all of this?
Well, yes.
Why? Well, yes. What's his objective?
He makes money.
Yeah.
And that's what they're saying. These people, and I'm like, why would you do this? It makes no sense. But these are paid thugs, like Antifa. Yeah. They get paid. Somebody's paying them to cause all this havoc.
Sharon in Texas with the skinny on Soros. And then Johanna rang in. Now living in Ireland, she was originally from St. Paul, Minnesota. And she and Sharon were polar opposites.
I would have been 18 the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, yeah. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and the riots happened at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they were all very real.
Yeah.
In 1968, I would have had great hopes that mm-hmm. this was the beginning of a new era. And now I just feel like I'm back in 1968.
And for Johanna, it was a case of Fox versus NPR.
We all listened to National Public Radio, and then there was a whole other sector of other people who would have only listened to Fox News. And a friend and I decided we're going to watch Fox News, because I said, look, we need to know the enemy, as it were. Not really, but, you know, we needed to know the other side. So we watched Fox News, and it was astounding in its incorrect and low level of reporting. My friend became so upset we had to turn it off. So if that's all you're watching is Fox News and you're only reading Fox Media, you're living in almost a parallel universe. The same factual information is not being given. And when the president said he's going to do something that, in fact, it's not possible for him to do, people don't take it any farther. They don't say that this is the Fox News. They don't say, well, actually, this isn't even possible. And I think he's basically feeding into his supporters.
Well, Sharon was a Trump supporter, so what was she tuning into?
Do you watch Fox News?
Right, yes. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And do you think it's biased?
No. Okay. No, it's...
Do you watch CNN? Yeah.
No. They do clips of CNN, I'm thinking of... Yeah.
Is CNN biased?
Yeah, I've tried watching CNN, but it's just like they're just so far off the ball. They don't tell the real news. And so that's why I've tried to watch CNN, I'm like, I know, just kind of like her and Fox. It made no sense. I'm like, this is just a whole lot of hate being put, and they don't give the truth. CNN does not portray the truth.
Okay, Johanna says that Fox News doesn't portray the truth.
Right, I know. But she's liberal and I'm conservative. Like I'm proud. Yeah, so that would make sense.
Sharon on Liveline. But lest we think this is simply a problem stateside, as the Black Lives Matter protests here demonstrated, it's an issue that is alive and well in the land of Cade Míle Fáilte. On Wednesday, Dr. Eben Joseph, race relations consultant and lecturer in UCD, spoke to Sarah McInerney. And Dr. Joseph gave her view on how the Irish government had responded, or in her view, failed to respond, and the visceral reaction she had felt to the death of George Floyd.
Do you know what? I wake up every day like this. For the past 7 days, I have stayed in my room and I have cried every day. Like, I just spontaneously burst into tears. Imagine, I'm just asking you and your audience to listen. Imagine now, if this was a reverse case and this happened in Nigeria and it was a white person that was killed by a black officer, the whole world would be in uproar. The whole world would have been talking. And so when we took 8 days as a nation to speak, we are saying that black lives don't matter. But you know, my greatest joy was a few days ago when I opened my Twitter page and I saw these two girls, Quiver and somebody else, two white girls, in front of the American embassy. And they had a poster in front of them. The poster said, Black Lives Matter. You know, in the middle of my tears, it gave me hope. When I saw the protesters in front of the embassy on their knees and I saw white, black, Caucasian, you know, just every different color and age and group and gender, it gave me hope. But as a nation, Leo Varadkar did not give us hope. He confirmed for me what I have been feeling. I wake up every day and I'm beating my chest because when I watched George die, I have never seen somebody dying. What that did was I watched a whole human being. I watched the life being snuffed out of him. And I asked, what was his crime? His only crime was the color of his skin.
And Dr. Joseph brought her rage and fear uncomfortably close to home.
How many people are just hating and waiting for the day they will be in position and in power where they can put their knees on our necks? In Ireland here, I can tell you, many of us, people of color, were beating our chest, and like George Floyd, we are crying, we can't breathe. In the labor market, we can't breathe. When we are trying to look for jobs, we can't breathe. When we look at that, despite all the qualifications people have, they can't find jobs, we can't breathe. When people are stuck in the direct provision for 5-10 years, what is their crime? Coming to seek for protection. We are all crying out, we can't breathe. What brings a 46-year-old man, I'm sorry, I'm just so upset. What brings a 46-year-old man to the point where he cried out for his mama who was already dead? And he was crying out, mama, I can't breathe.
Dr. Eben Joseph with Sarah McInerney on Wednesday. And all week on Liveline, we heard from young Irish people experiencing abuse, aggression and violence because of the colour of their skin. Jessie had attended the Black Lives Matter protest in Ireland and rang in to talk about the racism he had experienced.
I don't want to call it a protest. It's a march for awareness. People are replying saying, why are we walking? Our walk is not going to change anything happening overseas. That's not the only focus of the walk. It's to raise awareness towards things that happen here. Ireland needs to adopt a zero tolerance approach towards racism.
And Jesse, I'm sorry, some of those things you describe happening to you and your family are horrific. Were any of these people ever prosecuted or ever caught?
No.
They broke into your house.
They climbed over my fence, yes. We had a fence in my house. They climbed over my fence because people would walk through my garden and use it as a shortcut. So when we put up a fence, I think they kind of decided, they acted like we were antagonizing them, and then they decided to just vandalize the house. So spray painted the walls, spray painted the doors, writing ridiculous things, F-U, N-word on the walls. And it got to this, I've been so desensitized to it that I forgot that happened to me until this whole movement came, because I became so desensitized that that's a memory that I just completely disregarded.
Jessie on Liveline on Wednesday, and the following day, Kathy and Michelle rang in. They had been in O'Connell Street on Tuesday. Here's Kathy.
We were walking with our friends, like minding our own business, unprovoked, and this man just approaches us. He was first off staring at us, and then we looked back because we noticed him staring at us, and then all of a sudden he just starts shouting out racial abuse to us, like just horrendous things, like, and we tried to ignore him, you know, we tried not to say anything. He was saying stuff like, stop speaking that accent. He was saying stuff, just bad things I don't want to repeat on, you know, on the radio. It was just horrible. And like, then he starts getting like more aggressive, and then he starts like running towards us. He starts threatening us with like a bottle, as if he was going to throw at us. And it was all for nothing. And when all this was going on, everyone literally just stared and said nothing.
And for her friend Michelle, it was the lack of support from other people that really hurt.
And everyone else, like, just walking down the street, like, there was bus drivers and all, just walking down the street looking like nothing was happening. You know what I mean? Like, it was awful. Like, even someone just come up to us and saying, oh, don't be minding him or something, like, would have been a lot. Do you know what I mean?
And have you experienced anything like this before, Michelle?
Not in this serious. Like, before, like, I would hear, like, the odd, like, N-word or, like, last bastard and stuff like that, but not in, like, serious like this. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Kathy, what about your experience? Has it happened before because of your skin colour?
I think what it is like, obviously we don't document every single time it happened, but it's happened enough times. And, you know, obviously our parents came here as well. When they talk to us, they're like, if someone says this to you, just ignore them, because obviously to them, this is like the norm. But it shouldn't be a norm. It shouldn't be something that this might happen when you go out, so you have to ignore it. It should be that it shouldn't be happening at all, mm-hmm. you know? But in that situation, I was genuinely scared because he started running towards us, you know? And people were seeing him run towards us. Yeah, everyone else just watched. And like, okay, I guess sometimes you don't want to get involved. Maybe you're scared as well. But even the odds, are you okay, would have gone far. We would have felt at least, yeah, like, these people actually care. But they didn't care.
Liveline on Thursday. And yesterday, Trey spoke to Joe. He's in fifth class and read a letter he had written for a project on racism.
My name is Trey Jones. I'm 11 years old. People say I'm mixed race, but I say that I am black, because I know what people see when they look at me. I'm proud to be black. Since I was a baby, I've suffered from racism from adults and children who are white. I have been called the N-word so many times. I have been told to go back to Africa. I have been called chocolate-faced monkey and burnt, and that I'm a little slave boy. These things really hurt my feelings, and I will hear these things like this for all my life. I wish white people would stop being racist and be kinder to all races.
11-year-old Trey Jones on Liveline. Earlier in the week, Donald Trump had cleared protesters from the streets so he could be photographed holding a Bible in front of St. John's Episcopal Church. The image provoked an angry response from religious leaders, including Vatican communications consultant Father James Martin, who tweeted that Trump's actions were revolting and decrying his use of the Bible and the church as a prop and political tool. On the Leap of Faith last night, Michael Cummins spoke to Father Martin.
We're getting a lot of vitriol for speaking out.
Yeah, I don't mind. I really try not to talk about political matters because I think it divides people, and I don't want Catholics to feel like they have to make a choice. But on some things, you have to speak out. In terms of the murder of George Floyd, the use of the Bible as a prop, which really was disgusting to me. I mean, it really disgusted me. I thought I have to say something. And, he is sort of entering into the religious realm, and so I think it's a fair thing to talk about.
It also brings up the idea that a lot of people seem to be harboring the idea that Jesus was white.
Yes, well, that's false. I mean, Jesus was not white. I've spent a lot of time in Israel, and the people there have a certain complexion, and Jesus was not white. He was Jewish. He was for a time a refugee with his family, and he was poor, and he was a laborer. I think we need to remember all those things.
How do you keep the momentum going and the energy that has been released over the last week?
I don't think we're going to have to worry about that. And certainly it's not up to me. It's up to my African-American brothers and sisters. But I think that the outrage over George Floyd's murder has been compounded by people's frustration with the policies of this administration. And I think those policies just keep getting worse and worse and more repressive. So I don't think we're going to have a hard time keeping up the energy.
Father James Martin with Michael Cummin on the Leap of Faith. Back after this. Welcome back. Families in all their many guises and phases featured across many programmes this week, and we will start with birth. The Rotunda is the world's oldest maternity hospital, and it's also Europe's busiest. Evelyn O'Rourke scrubbed up and met Fiona Hanrahan, Director of Midwifery and Nursing.
So the word unprecedented is thrown around, but in my experience, completely unprecedented.
So your midwives are delivering babies while wearing PPE. You can't hug a patient.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of the big things the midwives have said to me is, you know, when you're with a woman in labour and the sense of elation and joy and achievement from the midwife, never mind the mother, your reaction is to put your arms around them to say, as a team, we did it. So the physical distancing has been really difficult for our staff. And they said, do you know, there's like a piece missing from every birth, and that piece is the hug. And it's something we've never had to even think about before. But often the partner wants a hug. Men get upset at births and they cry and they need to sit down. So it has changed the physical dynamic in the rooms. And we would always have worn masks and visors for the birth, but generally not for the labour. But now you just don't know. And that's been a big change around the wards as well. And I suppose for our students, it's very difficult. They're trying to learn their craft and their trade. And we talk about compassion and humility and all that stuff. And so much that is involved in hold the woman's hand, rub her back. So now you're saying put on a glove and rub her back, you know. So I think we've just got to find a new way of doing it.
Is it very difficult to work at the moment?
On the postnatal wards, it makes assisting with breastfeeding quite difficult. because you've got to be very close into a woman to help with breastfeeding. I mean, you improve your communication skills because we're saying to the staff, communicate with the woman first before you go in to give an actual physical hand. But our community midwives have reported to me that the new babies are putting on weight like no man's business because there's no visiting in the home. All the women are doing is feeding. So the babies are returning to birth weight at far quicker. So the newborns are thriving during the pandemic. Just let's just be assured about that.
Fiona Hanrahan, Director of Midwifery and Nursing at the Rotunda with Evelyn O'Rourke. So, the babies are flying it. But what about the young adults, those 18-year-olds about to plunge straight into life in all its messy glory? But with COVID-19, even seemingly small restrictions and disappointments are leaving their mark. Unlike family on Bank Holiday Monday, Brenda Donoghue spoke to Molly from Dungarvan.
What should you have been doing today?
Well, today, Brenda, I'm meant to be graduating from sixth year and leaving school and finishing school, and I'm supposed to be in school now just after playing my student teacher soccer match and getting ready for the mass that we'd have tonight and our goodbyes to the teachers, but that's not happening.
How hard is that?
I actually had a virtual graduation with all my teachers and my classmates there earlier. For an hour we were on Zoom and it was lovely to catch up with everyone.
Did it help?
Yeah, no, it really did help. Like, I was fairly emotional now this morning when I got up out of bed. Like, I was thinking, like, oh my God, I'm supposed to be finishing secondary school today. I'm actually supposed to be graduating. But look, like, the coronavirus, COVID-19, it has struck the world in so many different ways. Like, listening to my parents talking about their business, that's their life. But my life was school. My life was doing my leaving cert, doing my Debs, going on my sixth year holiday, turning 18, starting college in September. That's all gone, and it's just, everything is just uncertain, and we just don't know when anything's going to go back to normal.
What were your Debs plans?
My
Had
Debs.
You asked somebody?
Did I ask someone? No. Jeannie Mac,
well, at least
no.
You don't have that drama.
Yeah, I know. Oh, God. I think I was going to wait and ask someone maybe 2 weeks before. I was going to go to Independence in Mitchellstown 2 weeks before my Debs. And my cousin actually met a lad at Indy and she asked him a few years ago. So I think I was going to do the same because I don't have a boyfriend. So I don't know.
Aww. And of course, this came up.
Oh God, I'm watching Normal People as well and I'm like in love with Paul Mescal. Like you obviously know him because he's from Kildare.
I wish, but go ahead.
I'm just besotted by, and him, I just think it's brilliant. Him and Marianne, Conal and Marianne, get me a Conal.
Molly with Brenda on Like Family, and this next bit is just for you, Molly.
I'll go. And I'll stay. And I'll be okay.
Can I have a tissue? Oh man, life's so unfair. Why can't they be together? Ah, Normal People, the very beautiful Conal and Marianne and their star-crossed love. It is all over. And even Áine Lawler on the News at One had something in her eye when it came to talking about this great romance. She spoke to Element Pictures producer Ed Guiney.
It's very hard to do television because it's such a big, you know, a big set and all the rest, and you're trying to show intimacy between two people. And I don't mean physical intimacy, I mean the real connection. That's something you can imagine when you're reading a book. And what made this series so popular, I suspect, with so many people is that's what they saw on screen.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great synthesis of, you know, brilliant screenwriting, and Sally was involved in the screenwriting along with Alice Birch and Marco Rowe, Lenny's unbelievable filmmaking talent, and two amazing actors, and more than two, I mean, there was a group of amazing actors, but it was very intentional that, I mean, that all happens as a result of lots of conversation and planning, you know, and led by Lenny creatively, which means you have that kind of impression of a very, very intimate connection to these two characters who in a weird way cease to be fictional characters on a screen, and almost, you know, in the best case they feel like people you sort of know in the world, that you kind of know a Conal and a Marianne, or you know those two in particular.
And as to Conal and Marianne 10 years on, with saggy, wrinkly, maybe even a little bit bitter.
What many people want to know, is there going to be a sequel?
No, we never intended to do more than one season. There's been lots of speculation about this and lots of talk about it. But when we first set out to make it, it was very much just to make Sally's book and to make it in one iteration, if you like. And so so no is the short answer.
Never grow old, my pretties. Ed Guiney on Tuesday's News at 1. But when Marty Morrissey spoke to Paul Mescal for Evercornell, it was about, yes, the chain, but also the ga.
First there was the chain, and then there was that recent picture of you wearing O'Neill's shorts going viral. When I wear O'Neill shorts, Paul, nobody takes a blind bit of notice. In fact, most people laugh. So was this part of your plan to introduce Gaelic games to a global audience? Because you have.
To be honest, it was my grand plan of going up to the shop and getting a couple of cans of gin and tonic for the grand of you. But, that's the stuff that, like, it's hilarious, but it's that's probably the thing that requires a little bit of adjustment, just because I'm aware now that sometimes if I go to the shop, I'm being photographed. But to be honest, no better item to be photographed in than a pair of Minutiae shorts, I don't think.
Well, you've made Minute very sexy, I have to say. They'll all want to be wearing the shorts now. You know you've made it when you're the hot topic of conversation on Liveline, but when all the talk was about the steamy love scenes in Normal People, I was marvelling at your prowess on the football field. And then I learned you're a real-life Gaelic footballer. You played with Kildare.
Yeah, I played 3 years at minor and then 2 at under 21. So, it's kind of one of the things I'm like incredibly passionate about is obviously GAA, and to kind of get to bring that to, as you said, like not only firstly a British and American audience and obviously a domestic audience here, but now the show's been bought in like Brazil, Switzerland, like kind of all the distributors around there have picked up. I think it's sold to 22 countries recently.
Wow. So it's 22 countries.
Exciting. And they're all going to get bigger. They'll get to that scene in episode 1. They'll be like, what in God's name are these mental people playing?
But then Marty Morrissey took the Marty party one fat frog too far.
Is it true that you don't have a girlfriend?
We'll steer clear of that there. Yeah,
I don't blame you, but I just feel that when this coronavirus is over, you and I need to take a trip to Copperface Jack's. We'll have a night out, the two of us.
Absolutely. I don't think I've ever graced Copperface Jack's, but I'll go together, Marty.
Ooh, an image seared into the brain, Marty Morrissey on Bank Holiday Monday. So what about intimacy closer to home than love or even lust in the time of COVID?
Getting to know each other over coffee, gone. A trip to the cinema, a couple of drinks, gone. Dirty dancing and coppers, that's most definitely gone.
Did you hear that, Marty? Coppers, no. That was Drive Time's Barry Lenehan swiping left and right and all over the shop, because no less a body than Dr. Tony Holohan has advised finding one intimate partner.
So we've given clear advice around engagements between people between different households and the resumption of, if you like, intimate contact, close contact between people who live in different houses. That's not part of our guidance and advice at the moment. There is a lot of information for people who are in those situations as to how they can manage their relationships and themselves in those difficult settings. We know this is a challenge for people. Some people who have relationships who live in different houses, I live with somebody who's in that situation. And then some people who have relationships where just by virtue of timing and so on, they found themselves maybe stuck in a different situation, in a different country and so on, and they've had to do their best to try and maintain a relationship through all of that. That's not easy for people.
The public health team in the Netherlands is advising people to choose one intimate partner and stick with them. Would that be something that the team would advise here?
On the transmission of any infection that can happen as a result of close intimate contact, and that can be this infection, but it also applies to sexually transmitted infections generally, that is good public health advice.
So, belt, braces, mask, gloves and hand sanitizer. Check. But with 2 in the morning nightclub lunges denied us, where do you take the nod and wink? Online, it seems.
All the online apps have seen a huge spike in activity since the pandemic began, with Tinder reporting the 29th of March, 2 days after the Taoiseach locked down the country, its busiest ever day globally since the app was initiated in 2012.
That is a lot of swiping. Well, relationship counsellor Alison Keating felt there might be a possible upside to this new dating landscape.
What's interesting to me, though, is that, you know, from working with, you know, many people over the years who had tired immensely of the, I suppose, pre-COVID dating scene, men and women feeling under a lot of pressure, say specifically sexually, two specific things that have been taken out that people hadn't been able to go on date were sex and money. So it's like there's a new movement that's come in. It's like the slow food of you know, connections and dating. So things have, you've been forced to slow down. And some people are actually saying they're actually really enjoying that. And Match.com, they did a survey with 6,004 men and women, and they asked them, have they changed anything since lockdown in terms of their dating? And 6% had only used video chat pre-COVID. Well, 69% then became more open to video chat and said they were really enjoying the conversations they were having with people because there was no fear. Where are we going on the date? Who pays for it? Will I kiss them? Will I go home with them? And what people were having were really genuine conversations where there was a massive increase in self-disclosure.
There might be an upside to this whole thing yet. But for Irish Times relationship advisor and Fulbright scholar Roe McDermott, some things are just no-nos.
Some people may be gravitating back towards their ex during the pandemic. Is that something that should be avoided on, should be avoided, or perhaps to be expected given the unusual circumstances in which we are in?
Part of me that wants to embrace nuance and complexity says, look at the relationship you had with your ex, look at the reasons why you left. If you feel like this would be a safe person to go back with for a temporary fling and you feel safe and it's not going to reopen old wounds, absolutely. But generally, I do feel a global pandemic is an excuse for many things. Texting your ex probably isn't one of them. Maybe stay away.
Put it down. Down. Don't make me stop this programme. Welcome back. The poetry programme on Monday brought us poems from the pandemic. Here's Jessica Traynor.
In the days after the COVID-19 lockdown started, I saw one particular recipe for a baked good circulating around the internet more than any other. And it got me thinking, what is it about banana bread that makes us turn to it in moments of crisis? Banana bread. When civilization breaks down, the bananas are the first to go, their skins bruising hickory on sun-warmed windowsills. So we mulch them into batter, light the oven. Cinnamon warms our kitchens. Small comforts can be made from little deaths.
An ode to banana bread from poet Jessica Traynor. Beautiful, but perhaps not one for Paul Howard, the pen behind Ross O'Carroll Kelly.
I wrote a column about banana bread because there was this phenomenon of people baking banana bread furiously. I mean, banana bread is not nice. Now, I know a lot of people...
It is,
will,
come on. My wife Jenny makes a lovely banana bread.
It's like somebody who makes lovely hot cross buns. You know, they're only lovely up until a point. I mean, a piece of chocolate cake is lovely. Banana bread is just like, it's a kind of penance. You know what
it's
like?
It's not. Do you take butter with your banana bread?
I don't...
You don't take it at all, well, with butter or not with butter?
Not really. I mean, okay. I wouldn't go out on my way. For the last sort of 3 months, I've just been opening the fridge and eating the first thing that I laid my hands on. That's how bad things have broken down for me. But I wouldn't go looking for banana bread. But after I wrote a column when I realised this banana bread thing was becoming a phenomenon, and Surika bakes 8 loaves of banana bread and sends Ross out onto the Vico Road to deliver them to all the neighbours. And by the time he comes home, 8 neighbours have actually given him their banana bread. Right. So he comes back with the same number of loaves he left with. And when this column appeared in the Irish Times magazine on the Saturday, in the afternoon, one of my neighbours left a loaf of banana bread.
By way of a joke.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, though, because Circus was Donald Skehan's recipe, and then somebody else was doing Nigella Lawson, and then somebody else had the Happy Pears.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, my wife does a great one, but... there's chocolate on it.
Uh-huh.
And I think the thing I love most about it is the chocolate.
Right.
Ooh, Ray Darcy veering dangerously close to sourdough territory there. Gulp. But Paul Howard was also engaging in rather an intense level of gardening.
Like, I've been taking my frustration out in the garden, you know, so since March, any free time I find myself with, like, you know, I mean, while I'm waiting for the kettle to boil to make my coffee, I'm out in the garden just hacking away at things. And I have sort of obsessive compulsive tendencies. And I suppose they really come out at a time like this when you feel like you don't have any control over anything. You look for something you can control. So The garden has taken the brunt of this, so I'm literally on my hands and knees, crawling around on the pebbles, picking bits of leaves and bits of bark mulch out.
So it's looking good, is it? It
shouts out the window, "You missed a bit," and she's joking, but I'm serious.
Well, hands and knees is exactly where smut merchant Darcy would have you when it comes to gardening. Here's how he introduced this green-fingered legend.
How are you doing, Jerry?
Good, Ray, yeah.
Good to talk to you. So we have established that people are doing things in their gardens that they haven't done in a long time.
Yes. It's the most dramatic surge of interest in gardening since the 1990s, when gardening was known as the sex of the 90s. Of course, there was no truth in that, but anyway.
And you were one of the sexiest men on radio.
I know.
Well, there was something about you, Jerry, and there is still something about you. I meet people now and they say, "I'm delighted to have Jerry Daly back on the radio. I really missed him." And I don't know why, but I was a man with no garden in my 20s or 30s, and I used to tune in religiously every week. So there was something about it. There was something about it.
Yeah, well, there is something about gardening. It's just attractive to people, particularly young kids up till sort of teenage years, and then they get attracted to other things. But they very often come back to gardening then in midlife or in later life.
Yeah.
Jerry Daly and Ray with a bit of a love-in. Over on Bowman on Sunday, the focus was on just who got to dig the drills and set the seeds. Have a listen to this gem.
Women have a wonderful variety of ways of getting work done, and the method adopted will depend on the type of woman.
Gardening on Radio Éireann, 1961.
There are a number of jobs that need doing in the garden next Saturday, and we'll take a brief look at how a woman will get her husband to do them. The wife of the henpecked little fellow will just say, "Oscar, it's time the lettuce was sown in the garden now. So call into the seed shop this morning and get the seed." When Oscar gets home, the boss tells him to bolt his lunch and then to prepare the soil, taking out every bit of scutch and adding in some of the old manure and about 1 ounce of potato fertilizer per square yard. "Where will he find the fertilizer?" asks Oscar. "Don't tell me you forgot to get it, you imbecile. But that won't get you out of the job. You can sow the lettuce and scatter the fertilizer afterwards. And don't bury the seed or I'll bury you."
God, it's a bit extreme. I don't think either party comes out particularly well out of that one. Bowman on Sunday. Oliver Callan has been standing in for Ryan all week, and yesterday he brought us this wee nugget that Joe, wash your hands, Duffy, is writing a crime novel.
The working title is Fire in the City, and it revolves around a major crime planned in Dublin. So, I mean, what kind of crime novel will Fire in the City be? Will he go for like a noir dark thriller about the mean streets? Something that might sound a little bit like this. Dublin. Ballyar, a gritty city. I was just out of the big house talking to Two Fingers Fatty O'Flaherty when I saw her. What a moll. She was cute, cute as a bug's ear. Call me, I said to her. Or text 51551, wash your hands. She was dead gorgeous. And soon she'd be dead. But the killer left a note. It simply said, "Good afternoon to you." God, I'd read that. Or will be more kind of a chirpier one in the vein of Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote. Go ahead. I was just minding my own business by sticking my nose into everyone else's when there was blue, bloody murder. The killer had used a Mr. Freeze, you see, a blue one. I was drawn into the crime because the victim was reading one of me books at the time, one of the fantastic books. It was flying off the shelves in Easton. No one was buying it. It was just been robbed by lads coming in from Sally Noggin. Sally Noggin. And I hadn't a clue, me Noggin, what was going on. But it was a horrible, horrible crime, nothing to do with me.
Oliver does Joe. The films of Japanese director Akira Kurosawa were the focus for Reinok Negrier on Arena on Tuesday night. And in particular, the 1954 film The Seven Samurai.
But I think what makes Seven Samurai so prolific is everything down to how it defined the action genre with its visceral style, the movement within the frame, the kineticism.
Yeah.
But it also kind of... it's the visual language that you hardly ever need to be reading the subtitles to really understand the emotion and the feeling of what's going on there's always something like wind or rain or fire going on in the background. There's always a number of different people within one static frame to convey a certain emotion. And you just get this whole sense of how movement and the elements within a frame determine your emotional response to a film and increase your engagement with everything, not just the story itself. And I think that's what makes it so special and a million times better than Magnificent Seven.
And its classic status was confirmed when Rainock rewatched the film at the weekend.
It's nearly 4 hours long, so but it keeps you hooked scene after scene, and you never disengage from the whole thing because the characters are so engaging and they go through amazing and surprising arcs of every single one of the farmers who's involved, every single one of the samurai. But at the very heart of it, there's a really provocative message, which I think, you know, watching it again at the weekend, it kind of it's really evocative to watch it now, where you see a system of people working together from different worlds, strengths, weaknesses, experiences to fight a common enemy. And, you know, I think when the world seems to be kind of falling apart, the sort of collective struggle is worth fighting for. As one of the main characters says, by protecting others, you save yourself. And, it never ceases to kind of to rile me every time I watch it. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and a great movie will have that quality, that when there is a very difficult contemporary situation, a classic will speak to it in ways that you may not have noticed before, but that's what makes the movie classic.
Rainock Ní Gaoire with Sean Rocks on Arena. The drama on one this week was Longing Lasts Longer by New Yorker Penny Arcade. And it feels as good a place as any on which to end this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
You can call yourself a Buddhist without meditating, and you can call yourself an anarchist without reading Bakunin, but you cannot call yourself an activist without acting. I have always lived in the present. I don't want to be who I was then. I want to be who I am now, on the road to who I'm becoming. I was never a brownie. I was never a Girl Scout. I never joined the drama club, the glee club. I quit school when I was 13. I got put away with the Sisters of the Good Shepherd. Yeah, they wanted me to be a Magdalene. I never went to high school, university, or art school. I never took a queer studies class, a black studies class, or a woman's studies class. I don't need theory. I live my politics on the street with my body. Not on a velour couch in a student union with 8 other people who took the same class as me. No offense. God bless. I am sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is what it sounds like. You can only get this point of view from someone over 60. I'm sorry. We had the good drugs. We saw the good bands. We lived it, and some of us are still living it. I am part of the control group. But I know you don't have to be the same age as me or have the same experiences as me to think about the same things I think about, to be concerned about the same things I am concerned about. I know you're out there. I know I'm not the only one.